The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the trilogy.
The trilogy. We don't normally do more than one episode about a particular group.
We don't do trilogies. Normally, it's a double album. It sells, and then...
As soon as The Deep End came out, we got so many messages. And even still, they're asking us to interview more people, more survivors. People are fascinated with this story. I think our audience knows what they're looking at, and it's interesting for me to see, because Teal Swan is still active and she's still teaching, I am getting some pushback, some respectful and some less respectful from her followers. And it brought up a lot of stuff for me, because I realized that, you know, we were in a group that was under attack to a certain degree, and I got really good at defending the points.
Yeah, you have a holistic perspective on it.
Yeah, like I've been on both sides. And I do encourage our listeners to go to her blog and look at her responses, because she looks at the documentary and breaks it down point by point and basically says how it's all fabricated, all edited, none of it's true. And all the things that she's defending, she has a counterpoint to. And do you remember like when we were in Nexium and people would be like, but you guys wear sashes? Like, that's so weird.
Mm-hmm.
What was your response for that?
Yeah, it's taken out of context. I mean, it's more to represent the martial arts dojo. And depending on the person, they'd be like, oh, I can get behind that. Because if they're a martial arts person, they appreciate the structure. So you can normalize this stupid shit the way it was normalized. With us.
It was all normalized, like, you know, bowing, right? Like you bow to the dojo, you, like in the space.
But that's where it starts. It starts with normalizing things.
It starts with normalizing. But like, okay, let me just go through a couple points. Like if someone said, but you have an NDA, like, yeah, it's, you know, all companies who have trade secrets have an NDA. That's totally normal business practices. And I remembered that when Teal said, in defense of her non-negotiables contract, listen, if you haven't seen all four episodes of The Deep End, please do watch it, because otherwise this won't make sense. And to her credit, she does lay it out in a contract. This is what's going to be expected of you. Most cults have that as an unwritten format. So at least she has it written.
Yeah, hers isn't coercive. Hers is overt.
Yeah, overt control.
Overt control. It doesn't make it any less abusive, though.
Right. She says, well, that's what, you know, businesses do. It's just standard business. It's not standard business practice to have people put all of their personal needs and wants secondary to the mission of the company. That in and of itself is culty. We talked about that in our corporate culture episode. But I guess my point is that, like, if you're in a group and you're defending all these different points, and even after we left, remember, the people who stayed were like, well, you know, branding is normal. They do it in sororities all the time.
The process of normalizing abuse was already in place.
Yeah. And I remember for me, there was a very specific moment when I was leaving, when I took a step back and looked at all those things. And so you put the sashes and the bowing and the NDA and the secrets and the branding of the leader's initials, and you take a step back, it's 100% a cult, right? So you can point by point defend and change the meaning of every single thing, but it's just still what it is when you look at it objectively. And it's so hard when you're in it, you know?
Yeah.
Which brings me to my second point. Ethel brought up that it was edited. And of course, you can't put 3 years of someone's life into a docuseries without editing.
If editing is your only gripe, then I think you're going to have other problems.
Yeah. Well, the point I wanted to make is like, look, I've been there. We've been the subjects of, in my opinion, great documentaries, not great documentaries. And I've seen when things are edited out of context. It sucks.
Yeah, you're not going to like it.
No, you're not going to like it. That being said, you know, knowing, looking at the Sarma episode and Bad Vegan, it was very clear when the filmmakers took a phone call, and Sarma talks about this in her blog very astutely and in a very, what's the word?
Eloquent. Articulate.
Yes. Articulate. Thank you. Unlike me right now.
That's okay. You're doing great.
Yeah, coffee's kicking in. Thanks, babe. And she shows how, you know, the filmmakers took a phone call out of context and put it at the end to make it look like she was all chummy with him, which she was not. And she clearly states that she did that to record him saying crazy shit on camera. Now, Teal is saying things were edited out of context and things were hinted at like, you know, there's dead fish at the end. Did Teal kill the fish? Is she that diabolical? Or did Blake leave them out in the sun? Or maybe they just died in the transportation to this new location. We don't know. There's things that are alluded to. But there's other things that you just cannot edit that are clearly problematic. Unless they took her mouth and CGI'd her saying something and got someone to ADR her saying mean things to people.
The Teal Swan death stare. Oh.
Okay, final point. Final point I want to say about this. If you're a normal person, and listen, I didn't follow this too closely, but I just heard about how major pop star icon Lizzo, who, by the way, I've been so under a cult rock and then a cult recovery rock. I didn't even know who she was till we were at South by Southwest. I do know who she is now. Apparently, she said something in a lyric that was offensive to some people. And,
she Nippy, did?
Yes, but instead
she
of being
offended people?
Yes, well, listen, that's not my point. My point is, of saying like, well, suck it up, she said, I'm so sorry, I didn't intend to offend you. It's not what I stand for. Let me fix that. And she changed the lyric. And listen, I don't think that's appropriate to do all the time, but like, that's not what she was standing for. And she made a mistake and she owned it and she fixed it. So whatever you think about Lizzo or whatever, I don't even know the thing that she tried to fix. All I know is that she did that. And I just wish that like more people could do that. You make a mistake, you fix it. You don't go, no, you're just traumatized. No, you're just an ex-lover looking to grind your axe. You know, like it's just so irresponsible. The point is not to like pick on Teal or, you know, the point is to be able to look at how people handle these things and like what is culty and what is not.
Correct.
And it's happening all over the world in different contexts.
And the essence of our podcast, I think, is to draw the parallels of abuses of power and cults go on in the world. And I've been getting my Vaclav Havel on lately. He was the former president of the Czech Republic. And he has a great quote that I think encapsulates the behaviors of cults versus how you can apply it to what goes on in the world. And it goes a little something like this. The post-totalitarian system touches people at every step, but it does so with its ideological gloves on. This is why life in the system is so thoroughly permeated with hypocrisy and lies. Government by bureaucracy is called popular government. The working class is enslaved in the name of the working class. The complete degradation of the individual is presented as his or her ultimate liberation. Depriving people of information is called making it available, right? Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. The use of power to manipulate is called the public control of power, and the arbitrary abuse of power is called observing the legal code. The repression of culture is called its development. That's really what these cults are. The expansion of imperial influence is presented as support for the oppressed. The lack of free expression becomes the highest form of freedom. Farcical elections become the highest form of democracy. Banning independent thought becomes the most scientific of worldviews. Military occupation becomes fraternal assistance because the regime is captive to its own lies. It must falsify everything. It falsifies the past. It falsifies the present. It falsifies the future. It falsifies statistics. It pretends not to possess an omnipotent and unprincipled police apparatus. It pretends to respect human rights. It pretends to persecute no one. It pretends to fear nothing. It pretends to pretend nothing.
Ooh.
It's powerful, man.
That is powerful. It is powerful. Yeah. You know what? It's so great to be able to link these to other things, you know, and to draw the parallels. And I feel like very, responsible with this particular episode because there are people that are still involved and still using the quote tools that Teal's teaching. I feel like when we, you know, when we interviewed the director and producer of The Deep End, it was before the rest of the world had seen all four episodes. Like, we'd seen all four episodes. Mm-hmm. And then we interviewed them. And then we had like two to three weeks of a barrage of text messages, people being like, oh my God, do we have to do more on this? Please interview more people. And I feel like our chat with John and Bits, who I'll introduce in a second, was a little diplomatic compared to what I know now. Because since then, I've listened to, I know you haven't yet, Nippy.
Well, they have to be, and it's hard for
they
them
have
to
be. They have to be. It,
right?
But I don't want to be as diplomatic because I've seen John DeLynn on Mormon Stories interview Teal's childhood BFF, and it's like a 3-hour interview. So if people want to know more, we're not going to have her on ours because we do have to move on to other topics, but we'll put that in our show notes if people want to see specifically more about the patterns that are problematic. And the other thing I have to say, sorry, I'm like on a soapbox today, but that John really laid out that I kind of felt but hadn't said specifically for our audience. It's not just dangerous that she's potentially implanting memories of abuse. It's also dangerous that when people go through that, how do you think they're going to feel towards their family?
Mm-hmm.
And then that drives a wedge and that creates isolation. And we've known from all our episodes before, specifically with Alexandra Stein.
And it's sold as liberation.
Sold as liberation. Like, now you know and you're free and you can like, not, this is a reason for like the pain you've endured your whole life. A lot of people go through life feeling they struggle and they have pain. It doesn't mean they were abused specifically by your parents in a satanic ritual. You know what I mean? Like, this is very problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Should we talk about our guests?
Let's talk about them. You pump the tires, I'll pump some tires, and let's move on.
Well, our guests are legit. They're legit filmmakers. John Casbee is an Emmy Award-winning Australian Indian director and cinematographer. His debut feature, When Lambs Become Lions, was a 2017 Sundance Documentary Fund recipient, won Best Editing at the 2018 Tribeca Film Festival, and was nominated for 2 2019 IDA Awards in Best Cinematography and Best Editing. His film was released theatrically across the United States and is now available worldwide in VOD. His short films have screened at festivals worldwide and been recognized by South by Southwest, Hot Docs, Webbies, Vimeo Staff Picks, Camera Image Film Festival, Zurich Film Festival, Sheffield Film Festival, and National Geographic. In 2018, he was selected for Doc NYC's inaugural 40 Under 40 list. He's currently developing a new film in Concordia Studios' Artist in Residence. He is the real deal.
Bits Sola. Bits, I met in 2018 when she was working on season one of The Vow. Prior to The Vow, she worked on Persuasion Machines, which explored the underworld of data exploitation and premiered at Sundance 2020 and Netflix The Great Hack, chronicling the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal. The Great Hack premiered at Sundance in 2019 and was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Special, IDA for Best Writing, and BAFTA Award for Best Documentary. She previously worked in development with Oscar-nominated Emmy-winning directors Jihan Nugent and Kareem Amir across nonfiction and fiction projects. And she's currently producing a documentary featuring exploring the world of AI and robotics alongside John Casbee and Crystal Moselle. And a fun fact, Bits graduated cum laude in Literature and Creative Arts from Princeton University. We won't hold that against her, considering all the woke stuff going on campus there.
Isn't there like a rivalry about like Ivy League colleges being culty?
Right now there is. They're kind of under the gun because of all the canceling of professors and stuff right now. But I'm not really following
and
it.
And Jess got rejected from Brown, so she's like, fuck you, Brown. But what if she'd gotten to Brown at the same time as Nippy?
And she went to Harvard. Like, I think most people would go to Harvard over Brown.
She could have been at some of those parties where you were.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to say.
God. Thank God. If they had camera, oh shit, I don't even say that.
Let's just go to our guests and enjoy our interview with John and Bits about The Deep End. Enjoy. So welcome officially, John and Bits. We are ready to talk about The Deep End. John, you're the director. Bits, you're the producer of this remarkable doc series about Teal Swan that has just gripped us this past month. And we're just so glad that you're here today to talk about it. We just want to jump right in and talk about The Deep End. So right off the top, I want to mention, it's hard to not make the correlations when we watch shows like The Deep End because of our experience with The Vow. And we're always looking to see, like, how does a project approach something as sensitive as this? And one of the things that we really loved about The Vow and The Deep End is that I think that both show the audience what is the draw, you know, what is the appeal for your average person who finds themselves in a group like this. Otherwise, everyone just looks, if you just show the bad stuff, that people just look crazy and like total idiots for joining.
It's easy to dismiss.
And one of our things is in our space right now is really giving people the template to understand how these things look, what these things look like so that they can see the red flags. But like we're looking at it from the perspective of being ex-members of a cult, right? So we see these templates very clearly. You, however, have this background as being a verite specialist, fly on the wall specialist. Am I right? Is that a good way to describe you?
Yeah.
Okay. So you get into this situation. I'd love to know how you found yourself there and what your journey was like. How did you get this access? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. It was a very long process. Up front, I think it was really clear to me that I wasn't on either side when it comes to Teal. And everything I was hearing about her was pretty polarizing. People either loved her or hated her. I was hearing, you know, on one side, she has millions of followers and people are saying things like Teal saved my life and she's not afraid to speak the truth and she's healed all of my pain. And then you have a bunch of other people who are saying things like these techniques are really dangerous and she's attracting vulnerable people. So right off the bat, I think what really drew me to this was that dichotomy and trying to understand how these two opposing perspectives can coexist with one person's message and with one person's teaching. And in the, you know, that's a theme kind of in all of my work. There's some element of dichotomy and trying to understand opposing perspectives. And it's something I'm realizing with more and more therapy I'm very drawn to. As this project started, it really began by going and spending time with Teal and her community without a camera, just getting a sense for if it was a good fit, seeing if I was someone that they were going to open up to and if it was a project that I felt like made sense for me and where I was at. So we spent about a few weeks kind of talking, going through pretty much everything that can go wrong in the filmmaking process. We tried to get it all out like right up front, let them know that editing would take place and that it's an exhausting process, as I'm sure you all know very well from having gone through it yourselves, and let them know, you know, there's no creative control for them in this and they may not like what's made. And talked a little bit about our approach, which was that we wanted to understand the dichotomy in the situation and see it both from Teal's perspective, but from other people's perspective as well. And then create something that allowed audiences to do the work and decide for themselves what they think about what's going on. And it was really interesting to me. Teal's reaction to this, I don't know if you'd call it a pitch, but just to this conversation was really interesting because I think she really appreciated that honesty. You know, I think she'd felt burnt by the media in the past, and to have someone come and tell her like, hey, this is a messy process. It's not going to be smooth and it may not go well. And here are all the things that could go wrong. Saying that all up front and then working from that space, I think gave her some comfort because she felt like we were being real with her. She didn't feel like we're trying to trick her or force her, or kind of get her to do something she didn't want to do. And then I remember the next thing she said to me, she said, you know, John, it's interesting. You keep emphasizing how exhausting it'll be and how the cameras will be here all the time and how you want to film everything. But for me, she said, I actually feel safer when the camera's pointed at me because I've been through so much abuse in my past. When there's a camera pointed at me, I actually feel safer. So I know there's proof of whatever happened. So I'm never going to ask you to turn your camera off. For me, that was an amazing moment because I was like, wow, no one's ever said anything like that to me before. I've never kind of experienced that kind of perspective on filmmaking and documenting moments. That's kind of what kicked it off.
Did she see it as an opportunity, as vindication for herself, do you think?
Vindication meaning like in response to the way...
After being burned and having a bad rap and being accused of...
Yeah, I think she appreciated the approach a lot. Like it was really clear to her that I was going, that we were going through steps to try to understand what they were doing and the impact that they were having, and that we saw value in their perspective on that. And I think in the past they had felt that those steps weren't taken. I think she felt some hope that like this is going to be a more nuanced story that allows audiences to do the work and decide for themselves.
It seems like that's what the pitch was when Jennings did the podcast, but that didn't seemed to go the way that she wanted. It's amazing that she took that leap of faith again to say, here, open up, my doors are open, you know, record everything. But Bits, John, how did you two connect? And was there one that brought the other? Or what was the origin? What was the genesis of this?
John and I actually connected through a friend in the filmmaking community, a mutual friend who knew both of us and our work, and that we both have a similar approach to projects, which is really to go in and experience it for ourselves and embark on kind of a learning journey and really just connected us in a general sense, not with this project in particular in mind, I think just to connect us as people who might have symbiosis. And then we actually got started working on another film, which is premiering next week at Tribeca, called Sophia, which is about a humanoid robot called Sophia. And we started that, I guess it was a few years ago now. And then John and I were having a great time working together, and he told me a bit about this project and said, you know, if we do this, really, I think our approach in general, and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, had been, let's not go through all the media even that had been done about Teal thus far. Like, let's go in almost as blind as we can and just with an approach of openness. And we both felt equipped to do that with one another, and that we could trust each other to try to be sponges for that experience. And that kind of kicked us off. So it's been a really wild few years, and we made these two projects together, and you know, I'm sure we're going to need a holiday from each other at some point. No, I'm just kidding.
Or a holiday in general, because this is heavy. I don't know what Sophia is like, but The Deep End is, it's heavy. We loved the docuseries. We just devoured it. It was very captivating for us. And to be able to watch all four so close together and to really go on that journey with you, I feel like it's unprecedented access into this type of personality, whatever you decide about her. I mean, obviously we have probably stronger opinions that you may care to express, but we can do that because of our experience, you know, and we have a different approach.
I have a question for Bits, just in regarding, how did your experience of The Vow inform this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I get asked that question a lot, and it's a tough one to answer sometimes, because every project is so different. And the experience on The Vow, I think, prepared me and was beneficial to me in so many ways going into this. And predominantly, it was psychologically really helpful in terms of understanding the complexities of how someone can be helping and or harming according to, you know, depending on who you're talking to, and really navigating the difficult waters and understanding that you're very rarely dealing with two sides of a coin only, right? This is a holistic experience that even two people standing next to each other in the same room could have completely different experiences of that individual or that emotional process or whatever it is. So I think in terms of framing myself as an individual that way through the process of The Vow and speaking with so many people who had varying experiences, that was huge. But I know for both of us, and especially for me going into this project, I thought about it. I found myself feeling strongly that in order to go into this world and make this show, I really had to leave any preconceived notions at the door that I might have. And as I said, like, go in, use the word sponge. I keep saying sponge. I belong in a bathroom as a sponge, you know, treat this as something new, which it really is. And it's a different experience going in and immersing yourself in something as it's unfolding in front of you, which is what really excited me about this project, I think, coming out of The Vow, which was in a slightly different time frame.
So am I accurate then that neither of you listened to the Gateway podcast or consumed other media about Teal before you entered her world?
I listened to some of it. But again, I think it was really clear that what we were trying to do was different. I think for us, we were really less interested in trying to analyze and like determine truth in the past tense. And figure out what happened in the past. For us, we felt like we were much more interested in and felt like there was actually a space in the conversation to create an experience that could put viewers front and center in what it's like to be in a community like this and experience it for themselves. Because what I was finding when I was talking to people that were Teal followers or becoming Teal followers or kind of, you know, falling into our world, very few of them were listening to podcasts made about Teal or reading the negative press about her. That wasn't stuff that they were really engaging with. And so for our process, it was how do we do our due diligence to try to replicate that experience as close as we can to give audiences that, while also, you know, keeping in mind that there is a time to kind of zoom out and there is a time to get more of that perspective and those opposing voices, which I think, you know, people like Molly and people like Jared in the series are really helpful in providing that.
Remind me who Molly was. I'm bad with names.
She's the private investigator that Teal's team hired.
Yes, that was so fascinating that Teal hired Molly and that you had access to Molly's journey, because, you know, Molly finds what she finds and then eventually says it's going to be, you know, shelved, but it can't be shelved because it's in your documentary. So great, right? I mean, at least it was for me. That was a real win from our perspective. How did Teal choose Molly? Like, where did she come from?
So Molly had done another report on another group that had gotten some bad press and wanted their name cleared. And so Molly came in and did some investigating and put together a report, and she provided that to that community, and they found it really helpful. And so Matthias Thiel's manager was aware of that and reached out to Molly and was really looking for her to do something very similar. What's so interesting about the access that we had to Molly and the openness that Thiel's community and Thiel herself gave to us, what it said to me was that Thiel really, she really doesn't see herself as problematic. She's unapologetically herself about her methods, about her ambition. She's very transparent about how she has nothing to hide. And she also talks a lot about wanting to be seen. Like, that was her childhood trauma, was feeling unseen by her family. And so I think that's in part how she's set up, the kind of system that she's in, where she's surrounded by a lot of people who are constantly seeing her, constantly acknowledging her needs. And I think the filmmaking process in some ways added to that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There was a specific moment, I think, after Blake had left, where she's kind of just speaking out loud her own thoughts. She's like, I can't see what it is that would make him leave and all that stuff. And it was literally after the scenes where she was degrading him and his wife in front of him. And it seemed to me like there's a major disconnect in terms of like her abusive behaviors as to clearly why that might inspire negative press or whatever. And it's almost like there's two personalities.
She berated him and he says, I love you. And like, ugh, what a good soul. I cried a lot.
That moment, I remember filming that. There was something so real about just how complicated that moment is for both sides,
yeah.
For both Thiel and for Blake. And yeah, I think you can watch that scene a number of times and see a different thing in it each time, depending on, you know, whose perspective you're in.
But like the fact that you captured that, I mean, you can't, I guess you could write something like that in a drama, but like to be there for that moment of somebody, what I perceive as verbally degrading, like Nippy said, or abusing someone, and then for him to say, and I'm leaving and I still love you. It encapsulated so much of this, of at least for, even for us, even when we left, we were leaving a community that we loved.
In that moment, he seemed to embody more of what Thiel professes to embody, and her love seemed conditional. These are the conditions under which you can stay and love me. And he didn't meet him anymore, and she was dismissing him, and he actually embodied what I think she pretends to embody, unconditional love, and still held space for her, which was, to me, interesting. The message had worked on him, but not her necessarily.
Welcome to the complexity of the world, of this arena. I mean,
I think Molly said it, two sets of ethics.
Right.
Well, that was actually the other striking moment. Like, you know, when you're watching something and you're like a horror movie and you're like, don't go into the basement. For me, watching the moment where Molly is trying to tell Thiel what's cult-like about her program. And Teal's like, nope, I don't do that. Nope. And I'm like, you can't tell the person what they're not going to admit to the thing. Like,
the thing is, I think Thiel, she does a good job, but she does a front of that's what she's about. But then when presented, hey, this is where you could evolve, this is where you could, it's more no, my way or the highway, which seems to be, I think, her blind spot, or I don't know, something goes on there. Because it seems to me if she had those mechanisms in place, she might actually have a community that, barring the lack of standards and practices and untested in her methods, there's room there, because it doesn't seem like she's the typical sociopathic narcissist where they just deny everything and don't have any empathy. Because she seems to have empathy, unless she's acting, which I can't tell. But was that your impression?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what is so, you're hitting on a lot of the things that I think make Thiel so compelling and make it so easy to fall into her community. And when you're in there, it's really, really hard to see things clearly. You mentioned a few things. I'll just kind of go through them. I mean, this thing of like, she says the words that you're sometimes thinking in a way that completely takes the power away from them. Like an example in episode 4, when she's listening through all the things that she thinks that Yuliana thinks of her, she's saying all these things in a way that once that's done, it's like there's no power to those words anymore, because she's owned them and she's put them out there and she's saying, I'm not afraid of these terms. And then, you know, oftentimes finds a way to play mental chess with people around her that leaves them feeling like there's no move left. I mean, this is what we'd hear from Yuliana and from other people that had kind of been in her circle and tried to kind of express how they're feeling, tried to kind of stand up against what was going on. And I think when you have a mission like Thiel's that is so omnipresent, like ending human suffering, and everything is being done in service of that, it's hard to argue with it. It's hard to argue with it, especially when you don't have perspective and when you're in that environment all the time and being encouraged to share how you feel. I mean, this is one of my favorite moments was when Molly and Blake are on the phone and Blake is defending Teal as Molly is kind of asking him questions and trying to figure out what's going on and really trying to explain to him her analysis of it all. And he says to her, you know, Teal is so empathetic and she's always asking us how we feel about things. And it's true. She is. She is always doing that. And she does always open up that door. I think where it gets tricky is once that door is open and people go through it, then what happens? We've seen it play out in a lot of different ways, and it's not always just listening.
That was one of my notes to ask you, is that with a lot of groups that we've analyzed, and listen, we're not saying this is a cult and that's a cult. We're saying, like, what's unhealthy here? You know, what dynamic is not ideal for somebody's heart and psyche? And that's our job, right? Really, is to give people the tools to look at it, which I think your film does beautifully.
What's such a kind of a mind fuck about that idea is that it totally depends on who you ask. Like, there are so many people in Teal's universe who like swear by what she's doing, who aren't in the inner circle, who are saying things like, these techniques really helped me. And she's saying things that no one else would say to me. And traditional forms of mental health failed. And this is someone who is not afraid, who's willing to go to these darker places in a way that others can't. You know, the last thing we wanted to do with this project was in any way like discredit the experiences that those people went through. We wanted to represent that accurately and show that that's happening along with, you know, people like Juliana and Blake and Jared and other people who've been in the inner circle who came out really troubled by what happened and really confused and are doing, you know, years of work to kind of ground themselves outside of Teal's world.
Here's what we've noticed, because this happened with us as well. Like most of the people that took NXIVM and executive success programs, thousands of people, when we reached out afterwards to make sure people were okay or needed therapy, the people who needed help, like Jared and Ileana and Blake, in your project, they were the ones that were also inner circle, that they were close. People on the outside, most people said, oh, I got my money's worth. You know, I took a 5-day, I'm all the better for it, or, you know, no thanks.
Yeah, like, thumbs up, thanks.
Thumbs up. So that's pretty consistent with these groups, is that there's got to be good stuff on the outside that brings people in, and there has to be something of value. I have zero interest in discrediting those experiences either, because great, those people dodged a bullet, you know? But that's not what we're here to talk about. Like on our podcast and with the work that we do, we want to know what the abuses of power are. What was interesting about what she does, like with a lot of groups or cultic groups, there's a bait and switch. Join this company, but it's actually a sex cult, you know, or do this business, but it's actually like indentured servitude. Like there's one thing and you're getting another. But what her non-negotiables, her contract that she presents, lays it out front. Right? It lays it out for you and it's there and people choose. And she's apparently actively saying, do you want this? Are you choosing this? Are you happy? Which is similar, it feels similar to me is when I was instructed to say like, do you want this? And saying, master, would you brand me? It would be an honor. I actually didn't feel like I had a choice because there was a gun to my head of the collateral that was being held. And the years of what I'd put in and, you know, not wanting to look at like how ashamed I was underneath it all. Like there were so many things that were keeping that in place. When you look at coercive control and you can say, yes, they chose it or they agreed to it and it's all on the table, which is more than most leaders do. So like I commend her for that, saying like it's there. But at the same time, it's not really a choice. It's not really a choice when you're bound by like, if you leave, you have nothing. For when you're in the inner circle with a group like that, like it's very, very, very difficult to leave. Even if you're saying, I'm choosing this.
Also when you have buy-in too.
Yeah, the buy-in.
You know, you buy in, and then you get hit with another tab at the end of the buy-in.
Yeah. But like you see that with Blake. What was that like to be with him on that journey as he was like, we call it waking up in our podcast, like as he was slowly kind of coming to terms with what he needed to do? Were you like alongside with him? Was it a surprise? How did that feel being the fly on that wall?
Yeah, we were with him through a lot of that. And it was a surprise. I mean, the first time I met Blake and did an interview with him, he said to me, this is the most important thing in the world. I would die for this. I've been with Teal for 18 years and we're saving the world. I did not imagine when we started this project that he would leave. That wasn't something I saw coming. You know, over the next 3 years, as that transition started to happen, we were kind of shocked. We were kind of shocked as it happened. And I don't think it would have, like, Juliana was really crucial for Blake in leaving. I don't think he could have done that without her. And he's still on that journey.
It's always love. It's always love that gets you out of it. It's the elixir to all these things.
I think he's still on that journey. I don't think he's finished. I think he still wrestles with it regularly. I think he's still trying to make sense of it and figure out who he is outside of Teal and what his purpose is outside of Teal. I can imagine it's really, really hard when you know, 18 years have gone into everything.
I'd actually be interested to hear from you guys, Sarah and Nippy, as well on this in terms of this is stuff that happens over time as far as we saw it. And there was like a seed buried in that, I think, that where they could express interest in traveling or in doing other things, you know, prior to this moment of departure. And there were, you know, seemingly catalyzing things along the way. But it feels like there's not always this one moment where something shifts, right? I mean, it's something that evolves over time as you gather new perspectives. I mean, I'm interested.
Well, Sarah has the shelf story that she likes to tell, but mine was a little different. So tell yours.
Sure.
Sarah.
Yeah, it's a metaphor we use a lot in the podcast. Actually, I think I got it from, was it from this book, Take Back Your Life?
Yanni Lalich.
I happen to have it right here. It's my personal cult recovery Bible. But yeah, there's this idea that things happen you can't wrap your head around because of the buy-in. You don't want to leave. You're too invested. And you compartmentalize, or what they call it, shelving it. So you like put it on the shelf. It's the same thing with domestic abuse. The first time the partner hits you, you don't go, oh, I got to get out of here. This is really awful. You go, well, he was just angry or whatever. And you put it on the shelf. So you put these things on the shelf, and eventually the shelf gets so heavy and there's almost always one thing that causes the shelf to collapse. And that's the final straw. But that thing isn't the thing. It's the last of many things. And I don't know what it was like for Blake, but watching it, I felt like the shelf broke when Teal publicly berated Ileana in a, I don't know what that group was called. I called it the projection circle because everyone was just projecting
all their own hate towards Teal.
All their own hate towards Teal through Ileana. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. That, by the way, that scene was super triggering because that's the kind of thing that would happen in a Nexium breakout session where someone was getting feedback. It felt like a lot like that, where you can't say anything. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you say, no, that's not how I feel, then you're lying. If you say how you feel, then you're a terrible person. So like, again, cannot believe you captured that. And the look on poor Ileana's face, I wanted to scoop her up and take her away from that nightmare.
And Bits, to answer your question, I guess my shelf would have been everything that I'd heard about him, that I had gone to everyone and questioned and asked in the moment of hearing Sarah's story, all was true. So everything that was false was now true. And then the true person was clear to me.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
I want to go back because I think there's a distinction to make. I can't remember where I saw it, but in our cultic travels, I heard a description of people pursuing the influence, and strictly the influence, generally don't end up falling in the demographic of abusing power. But it's if they sink the power and following in addition to the influence is when the problems arise. And it seemed to me in those moments, like if I was watching Teal, is like she started to recognize that her power was being threatened. And she always felt like people were threatening her power. And if she'd just been comfortable with her influence, it seems like she could still do this and pivot and adapt and change over time. But it seemed like anytime she was questioned, her power was being threatened. And to me, those are indicative of someone who is consciously or unconsciously abusing their power for me. And those would I become like really allergic to when I see it. Right away.
I think that's really intuitive.
It's not mine. So it's just, it's.
No, yeah. Whoever's it is, they're onto something. I think you said it all. Yeah.
I have a filter for that. It's like, if this person didn't have their power, I think they'd be upset, but the influence is the objective and not the power.
And to loop back to what John said at the beginning, if you look at her desire to be seen and heard, the power gives her that. And I don't want to get all Nexium on this, but like they would have called that her inner deficiency.
Her inner deficiency
is what drives the pursuit, which is, by the way, the same thing as what the completion process seems to be, is to look at like what the trauma was as a little child that drives all the behavior as an adult, and you want to complete that. So like the main problem that I see, and I think that the series really exposes this, is that regardless of whether she's good or bad or light or dark or helping or hurting, there's nobody she's accountable to. And that is the main thing that strikes me is like that. I mean, if she really does want to help people, mm-hmm. and she still can, she needs to be accountable to somebody. She can't be the end all be all. She can't
lambast people who challenge her.
She can't lambast people who challenge her. You know, and one of the lines, again, I'm so impressed that you got this. Somebody said very casually, well, that I don't know if that's true, but Teal's psychic, so she knows. And that is such a protective mechanism for her. Anything she says is truth because she's psychic and can't be questioned. And if you question it, you're an enemy. That's a problem for me.
Well, if she's psychic, she would have known this documentary was going to get made.
That's Sorry. Coming up in the comments. That's coming up in the comments for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the response been, John? Both of you, John and Bits, what's the response been like?
It's been all over the place. We've gotten positive and negative. There's some people who are reaching out who are loving it, and some people reaching out who aren't liking to see Teal this way. So I think for us, you know, I think we knew going into this that it's always intense mm-hmm. to see 3 years of your life compressed into a series. You know, I think that's a lot for anyone. I think to agree to do that, to open up your life, to get vulnerable in front of a camera takes a lot of courage and takes a lot of bravery. Mm. At the same time, you know, I think we knew going in and coming out, there are going to be things that some people liked and some things mm-hmm. some people wouldn't like. And we're going through all of that right now. We're experiencing all of it. But I think that what's interesting is that when you say that you can read people's minds and predict the future and see all energy and understand the universal perspective of the world and channel any consciousness, but then also feel like you've been wronged by, you know, media in the past or present, it creates this interesting situation where it's like, I don't know how you can have both.
I think through this whole process, we've always felt, again, to John's point, some people would like it, some mm-hmm. people wouldn't like it, some mm-hmm. people would feel like it was a portrayal that they resonated with by their experience, or it wasn't. We've always felt like it would be what people came in with would obviously color their experience of the show. And so in making this, I think we've both been litmus tests for each other in terms of saying, does this feel true to the experience that we had in the field? And if so, then of course we stand behind the work and it's going to be received however it's going to be received. And John always says this thing, which is, there's a point at which this is contained and obviously before it's released. And then once it's released, it can become something else. It takes on a life of its own and the domain in which it's received is variable and changeable. All we have control over, of course, is the work and if we stand behind it. And I know that we both do.
Mm-hmm. So do you think you did the documentary you wanted to do? And in hindsight, did you leave anything out? Would you have done anything different knowing what you know now?
It was so hard. Mm-hmm. It was just so hard. I don't know that I would say we would do something different in our approach. When I think about like going into it without preconceived notions, like I really stand by that choice. I think that was crucial for us to do it. I think going in and really experiencing some of the processes so that when we're filming people going through these emotional experiences, we understand on some level what they're going through because we've experienced it. Like I really stand by that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think crafting something that is designed to be focusing on the emotion of what's going on rather than just the logistics of it and letting that drive the story. You know, I stand by creating something that allows audiences to do the work and decide for themselves what they think. I really believe in, like, I really struggle when I feel like I'm being spoon-fed an idea or I'm being forced a perspective. I like doing the work. When I think about the films that I like the most, it's always the ones where I can tell that the filmmakers came in and they went through an experience that changed them.
Absolutely.
And you feel that through the story. You know, I love experiences like that. And that's by design. That's why we were really trying to not have a super solid perspective on all of this when we came in and really stay open and then let it form naturally over time. And I hope that comes through in the series for people and that they can decide for themselves what they think. You know, I think if, you know, 100 people go in a room and watch this and at the end of it, they're split, I think that's a good thing. Like, I support that. I think when the film ends is when the conversation begins.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of like what we made, there's not a lot that I'd want to necessarily do differently. The approach, you know, took some years off our life for sure. I think we're all really tired and I think we're all a little bit bruised up. And I think we need time to just kind of like let it all settle and process everything we went through. But I don't know, you know, I don't know, Bits. I don't know if you would change the process. It also like, it pushed us like crazy. Like we learned so much.
Yeah, I became a sound person.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask how many crew were there? Like how many people were there to have that kind of verite style?
Yeah, it was small and intimate. John is the primary shooter on the project and is obviously a stellar mm-hmm. cinematographer. And I'll say that about him because he can't say it about himself.
We'll back that up. Shot beautifully.
Exactly. Yeah. And proof is in the pudding on that one. And then there were a couple of other cinematographers who would come in and be the second camera when we had the opportunity to shoot with two cameras. And then I was the producer on the ground and also for about half of it, also the sound recordist. And then when I wasn't recording sound, we had another sound recordist. So it was 3 to 4 people throughout.
That's pretty intimate.
At the end of the vow and after everything that we went through, I would still say that there's some things in the 5-day I would send a friend to or have them take a look at if they're struggling with something. Would you send a friend or family member to a Teal Swan workshop?
Man, you keep coming in with these killer questions. Relentless. No, these are great. I don't feel like there's a one-size-fits-all to healing, is my stance on this. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all.
That's safe. It's a safe
answer.
It's also the truth.
I mean, it depends on the issues they're dealing with. It depends on their sense of self. I think when you take really vulnerable people who don't know who they are, who are really struggling, who feel like there's no other answers, and you put them in an environment with someone who is one of the most emotionally intelligent people I've ever met, but also has a real tendency to struggle with being seen and control, it's a tricky cocktail. Mm.
Something I'll say though, having been to, obviously we went to a number of retreats, the smaller retreats, as large auditorium style workshops. Part of what I think has, you know, huge value is the connections that people made with other folks who are having similar life experiences. And it was a super supportive environment. Yep. I think you see it a bit in the show. I think we saw obviously significantly more of everything than what is, just in terms of number of days that we did. We saw a lot of that. And that was something that we thought was important to convey, but also something that we really felt and I think has value. Finding community
100%
in the world right now, it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to do.
Nippy and I have never been suicidal per se, but we've, been into dark places in our lives and can certainly speak to that. And it's something I miss the most after not being in NXIVM. It's why I chose, why we chose our son's school because of the community there. And now we kind of have this like ex-cult member community and the hashtag I got out community and trying to make sure it stays healthy, because I think that really is the challenge always, is how do you keep something like that free of abuses of power? And we talk about this nonstop in our podcast. There's always good things in these groups. Mm-hmm. Always. It can't just be like the worst abuse from day one, because why do people join? What are those good things? And can you have them without the potential for being hurt down the road is really what I personally struggle with. And I think you achieved your goal of having people start the conversation when it ends. Nippy and I are certainly still going back and forth. I will say that I still don't know for myself personally if she has special abilities.
I dismiss that shit right away. Yeah. That's a red flag to me.
I believe that people have abilities that are not measurable and can. And like, I do believe in certain things.
If you can't measure it, I don't think you have it. It's just your word.
This is a great example of the conversation. Nippy and I don't agree about, and listen, like I see a spiritual coach, counselor who, sages me and smudges me and has crystals on me. Like I do believe in a certain amount of that stuff. I will just never join a group. I will just never, adhere to a doctrine or like give up my life. And that I think that is a line that you see with your movie, is there's the people who are part of the community and they just like use the tools in their life and have found like-minded people. And then there's people who give up their lives to follow a leader. That's the inner circle. That's where shit gets dangerous.
John and I have had this same conversation that you two are having many times, because I think we also were impacted in different ways by different things that we saw and experienced in our direct interactions and interactions with others as we moved through this, making this project. Mm-hmm. And, there have been things like I think in episode 1, 2 people on stage and 1 woman on stage says she was the child of an affair that ended a marriage, I believe it is. And the other person had the same experience. And these are 2 people who didn't know each other, who were both pulled up on stage. And that was something that was a serendipity, as you would describe it.
Magical.
Yeah. I think there are things like that were really amazing to see and were the foundations for connections between people who may not know each other and feeling that there was a shared trauma or shared experience.
Yeah. I think too, the line between like a really high level of emotional intelligence and like magical powers is slippery. Mm-hmm. The number of times that we watch people go up on stage with Teal and do what you could call a therapy session in my experience with therapy, it's like you sit with a therapist and they listen and then they kind of guide you, and when you come to a conclusion, when you come to an answer, it's something that you've done on your own. And so you have ownership over what that is. And what I saw with Teal on stage was very different. She's saying to people like, I can see your truth because I can see all truth. And so I'm telling you things about yourself that you don't know. And I think that's something that is really alluring and magical, because it feels like there's someone who has these powers that is showing you something that no one else could show you.
See, I think that's dangerous.
Yeah. You know, there's times where we saw that and we would talk to the person afterwards and they would say things to us like, that felt like 5 years of therapy compressed to an hour. This is incredible. This has changed my life. Like, I can't believe I figured that thing out about my mom, or I figured that thing about my dad. Mm. There's other times we saw that play out and it was really unsettling. And it was like, I don't know where that's coming from. And it doesn't seem like that's sitting right with this person. And I'm worried about what's going to happen next.
Hey, A Little Bit Culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trekking along. Thanks again. We adore you.
I think the word truth is an interesting one that we're throwing around here, kind of objective truth, subjective truth. And I always think about, you know, back when Matthias hires Molly and says, we want the truth. And if there's something we're not seeing, we want to see it. And that's really what a lot of this emotional work in general, I think, is about, is like, what am I not realizing that might be causing my life to be going in a direction that I don't want it to, or what's wrong with my relationships or whatever. The word truth, I think we encountered in so many different environments over the course of these couple of years, that it's exactly the reason why John and I never claimed to be arbiters of truth or like revealers of truth or expose, you know, because some of these truths were able to coexist and some of them weren't.
Right. It eliminates a nuanced dialogue and it becomes more of a monologue.
She's just telling.
So she's no longer eliciting and checking. She's commanding. I mean, Tony Robbins does a little bit in his workshops. You know, I'm not picking on Thiel. I'm just saying, generally speaking, there's these people who have anointed themselves some sort of authority. And then in front of a group of people, you know, I can remember watching a Tony Robbins one where he's like, we're talking about your mother, your father, which one is it? And the person was like, hold on. It's like, which one is it? And it was something like that. And it was like, because they were in front of a group, they didn't want to look bad standing up to Tony Robbins, but they just didn't necessarily agree. And the person felt kind of, maybe bully is a strong word, but it does feel like emotional bullying in a lot of ways if you just don't take it in. I guess that's where if I'm going to articulate it further, that's where I kind of draw a line.
Can I draw another one?
Go.
I feel like in those moments that you just said, John, that's a really key thing. Like, my parents are therapists, so I feel like pretty clear on this world and what's okay and not okay. And I agree, in therapy, you want the person to come to it themselves. And that, and next thing, we called it an aha or an integration. We go, oh, that's why I thought she didn't love me, but she actually did because she loved me. And you have this big cry or whatever, but you come to it yourself. I feel like with her, she's saying, well, that's because your mother never loved you. So A, she's making assertions about things that she says are true because she's psychic and she sees it in the field or whatever. Maybe that's true. Like, maybe that's the truth, that like the mother never loved this poor person. But if that's true and that's helpful to the person, now the person isn't dependent on Thiel for that awareness and feels more hooked into like, well, now I need Thiel versus I've just had an awareness. I can go back to my life and be free, you know? So that's another problem, is creating the dependency from the work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's almost like a starvation pattern. Equally as interesting as like Thiel doing this is that people are drawn to it. These very like concrete answers, these very like, I will tell you the answer. This, like, that was something that drew me into this early on, was that people were drawn to that. Someone else doing the work for you, and that being an attractive thing.
Quick tangent here, but there was a number of moments, you know, watching it and imagining being there, because I really did feel like you did a great job of bringing the viewer into the room, like feel like you were part of that circle and part of the conversation. I don't know if I could have, as a filmmaker, not be like, okay, stop. Okay, you're not answering his question. You're gaslighting him. Like, was there ever a point where you felt like you wanted to intervene and like save people? Because I definitely had that. So I'm wondering if you did too.
Yeah. There was a lot. I mean, this was one of the hardest parts of this process, was remembering our role and, you know, knowing when it was appropriate to put the cameras down and mm-hmm. join the conversation, and when it was really our job just to stay back and to just document and to save what was happening. And it happened a lot. There were a lot of times where we saw things going on that we wanted to intervene, that we wanted to say something, that we wanted to just give someone a hug.
Totally. Did you ever off camera, like, hug someone and be like, it's going to be okay, or like, let's get you out of here or something? I don't know.
With the participants at the mm-hmm, workshops, mm-hmm. it never felt appropriate. You know, it really felt like that would be crossing a line. Mm-hmm. But I think with Blake and Juliana, it was very different. You know, we were much mm-hmm. closer with them, and we were, you know, filming them in there and like separate from Teal and the community, which was nice to have some space and to have a lot of conversations where the cameras weren't on.
Yeah, I bet. How are they doing now?
Mixed. You know, I think they're both in different places. So they're going through that process where, you know, you're in a marriage, but both at different stages of processing what's going on and what you've kind of come out of. And I think they're each other's support, but I also think it's really intense for them right now as this documentary comes out. And as, you know, as one of the hardest years of their life is kind of being displayed to the world. It's hard. It's really hard.
Oh, trust me. We know what that's like. When your trauma is on screen for everybody to see. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But I think, you know, at the same time, I think they see a lot of value in this. And I think what they hope is that other people watch this and learn and can see their own life experiences through the series and can come away with their own lessons. I think that's a big motivation for why they gave us so much access as well and let us in.
Well, they are helping. That's the thing, is they are helping with healing pain in a healthy way, I think. And if there's a way for us to get them a copy of Take Back Your Life, we'd love to help in that way. They're open to it. I don't know where they're at, where their healing journeys.
That's a good idea. I'll ask them.
Yeah. Maybe I can send you some links.
One more question. I couldn't help but feel like, I don't know if it's the right word or not, but it seemed like a lot of what you captured were like kind of temper tantrums out of Teal in a lot of ways. And I'm wondering, when the cameras were off, was it more like that, less like that? Or did it feel the same kind of tension?
I would say that I think we both feel, I keep saying this, but I can't say it enough. Like, I think we feel like what is in the series is representative of all of our experience and feels true to the spirit of
what you came to do,
of what happened and what we saw. John, would you, is there anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to give like the iceberg analogy. Like, the film is like the top 10% of the experience. There's a 90% underneath it. And, you know, I'd say half of that was a shot. Like, a lot of these scenes you're seeing play out are things that we experienced without cameras first. I think that's a part of how we're able to earn these scenes, is because, like, the first time, you know, Blake and Juliana get in a fight, the first time that Teal gets upset with Blake, like, all these are things that we saw first when we were just there. So by the time that we were filming, they were used to us being around for those types of instances, those parts of themselves that they knew we were conscious of them. They knew we'd experienced it. And some of these things you're seeing Teal do to other people, we went to ourselves. Like, we felt that happen to us.
That's what I was going to ask you, actually. Did you ever feel?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we did. I mean, I don't want to draw a comparison to what Juliana went through, because it's very, very different. And, you know, I'm a filmmaker and I'm able to leave and I'm there for a purpose. You know, I'm not married to her right-hand person, so it's very different. But there were times where, you know, Teal had questions about some of the things we were filming and she didn't like them. And the way it was handled was the whole community stayed up from, you know, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. all just like at me, just going at me about, like, you know, why did I want to film this? And what are my motives? And how am I going to craft the story together? And it just went on and on and on
on.
And it was one of those situations where I was trying to respond with logic and being honest and raw and helping them understand how I was thinking about it and what I was going through, but it didn't seem to matter.
I think in terms of what you're saying also, and to your question, Nippy, about what you saw in terms of, you know, what you called a tantrum or a discussion that felt like it had a certain quality to it. It reminds me, Sarah, what we were talking about a little bit with on the editing front of, I know there's always this question of like how much was something edited. I'm interested because we know what our experience is and we obviously stand behind it as representative of that experience. But to you guys, like, how did those moments feel to you guys?
Well, the films have to be edited. Like, you can't just have like one camera for 10 minutes on one person, right? But the clips that were uncut were raw and real enough to me to have a very strong perspective in terms of what I believe is unhealthy. Again, I go back to what I said at the beginning. She may or may not have special powers or really good IQ or EQ, I mean, as you said, John. Assuming that she does, let's say she can help people, a lot of people were helped, the way she's treating people on top of that is super problematic. And you can see that in those moments, edited or not edited. Like, there's no way you could edit that to look. The moments are pure enough. It's undeniable. to me.
It's undeniable that no matter whatever is going on with Teal, everyone else has to go through it as well. To me, that's an egocentric, well, you can add whatever clinical term you want, but it's like the mood of everything has to go through Teal's mood.
And if you didn't put ominous or dark music and you put like happy music under it, it would still be problematic.
Yeah, it might even be worse.
Do you know what I mean? It might even be worse because she would look next level evil. You know what I mean? Yeah.
It is worse, just to be clear. Yeah. It's worse. We tried. Yeah. We tried. It's worse. Yeah.
And listen, I know that you can't speak to this, but I'm going to speak to it. And, you know, we've dealt with another spiritual guru type character in our podcast. And then we followed the aftermath of his response to the media. And we broke down his response step by step of basically none of it's true. Everyone's liars. Everyone's a disgruntled lover. The media is unethical. And people just aren't enlightened enough for my work, essentially. And for us, seeing Teal's response, and we actually have already encouraged our listeners to go look at her blogs to see what the response is, because to us, it's just more indicative of her not taking responsibility. Like, if she really is the enlightened person she says, she'd go, oh my God, shit, I've hurt people. How can I fix this?
But wouldn't you say, Sarah, there is a yes, but to Teal? Because there is that moment where she seems legitimately concerned about why she's driving people away. Now, I don't necessarily think it's for the altruistic and humanitarian reasons. Maybe she's losing her power. But traditionally, I've found that the real extreme ones that we've talked to just don't give a shit. And they say, they're the problem, blah, blah, blah. And it's that gaslighting disparity and they're the problem and I'm not is more black and white with them as opposed to it was with Teal. I mean, that's where I would say the yeah, but with Teal, if there is a yes, but. Because it just seemed a moment of like, is she in pain? Is like she really like, there's an empathetic aspect to her that I think the previous ones we've looked at just don't have at all. Would you say, Sarah? I don't know. I got that hit. Would you guys say, John?
Yeah.
Bits?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, the moment that really stands out to me mm-hmm. is when she's, you know, talking to the camera in that very vulnerable moment after Blake has made his post.
She tears up.
And she says, you know, like, I know I have to consider that I could be the bad guy because that's what I teach other people to do. But when I look at myself and my actions, like, I can't figure out what I could have done differently.
That to me was like,
I mean, can I tell you?
I know. I was like, can I tell you, Teal? Because I saw it and I think I could help you here. So
I'll talk to her. I'm not afraid of her. I'll tell her what she could do differently.
Yeah, listen. I'll email her.
If she
her.
Really wants to help people,
yeah, I'll email her.
I would totally have Teal on this podcast. Yeah. I would. Get my gaslighting armor ready and I'd be just ready. I have dreams about, because people gaslit the shit out of us when we were in NXIVM. I didn't know what I was looking at, right? So I have these like fantasies where I'm like head to head with Nancy or Keith and I'm just fucking giving her and being like, that's not an answer. You're putting it back on me. You're not taking responsibility. Like, I just fantasize about that. So I feel like if I could do that for other people, for Teal, it would be really cathartic.
I'd be interested to see what happens if you made that show. I mean, I will say that was something that I think when Teal spoke with Molly on that Zoom, and Molly asked his really direct questions, Teal answered that. I mean, she answered them how she answered them in a way that she
way too quick though.
Felt was
way too like yeah. nope.
It was surprising to me. I actually didn't know. We really didn't know how that was going to go. Obviously, we never know how any of the things that we capture are going to go. But to her credit, she isn't afraid of someone asking her those
right.
questions.
Mm-hmm.
That was something I hadn't seen before. She's like, okay, cool. People are accusing me of X, Y, and Z. And I'm going to tell you from my perspective what I think about it. I think John and I both, when we were in that room, were really surprised with the directness, the approach that she took.
Yeah, the difference is with the sociopaths or whatever, they never put themselves in a conversation that they're not curating. And Teal seemed to be willing to do that.
Yeah, I don't think she's a sociopath.
No.
I think she's narcissistic. I don't know if she's a sociopath. I know you guys can't comment. This is my...
Yeah. No, it's fun. It's fun watching you all wrestle with it.
Your internal monologue.
I don't know, but that's great. You did a good job then with the film. This is the conversation. And if you want to take a look at our Instagram post, our listeners are weighing in and sharing and talking. And I mean, this is a very curated audience. They're listening to a little bit culty. So they do have a preconceived notion, I suppose, already.
So what's next for you guys?
I'm going to rest. I'm going to not make plans. There's a bunch of other ideas of projects that are kind of been in development for a while, but I think I need to take a break and step back and figure out what I want to do next. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, likewise.
I feel like I need to give you a hug. You've been through the ringer. That's a lot. I didn't realize it was so intense for you.
It's been a lot. And the schedule was pretty insane too. This was a fast edit. And also I just want to like shout out to our team. Like, we had some amazing editors on this that gave so much. And really, you know, we go through our own experience in the field, but then they go through their own experience, like wrestling with thousands of hours of footage. And so I can't give enough credit to those editors who are the brilliant minds, the smartest ones in the room that go through and find a way to communicate the story in a way that's digestible and makes sense and hopefully resonates with people.
And the producers, we're going to call them out as well. My cohort over here as well, who also, no, I mean, the whole team, it was a real team effort on our end. And I know I certainly feel really grateful to have a collaborator in John with his kind of perspective and approach to this stuff. I think it's super unique. And I think it's the reason a lot of our team decided to join this project and tell this story with us. It's just like a testament to his work.
Well, congrats to you guys. That's great.
Yeah, congrats to a successful film in the golden age of...
It's golden, Sarah?
I think, cult awareness.
Is it golden?
The golden age. Yeah, well, I mean, listen, it's a trend.
That's what they're calling it, Nippy. Online, everyone's calling it the golden age.
I think it's important.
The golden age.
People can educate themselves and learn.
Yeah.
So thank you for being part of that. Really appreciate your time. You guys are awesome and very vulnerable, and we appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks for coming on, guys. Thank you.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. Because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
Thank you to our guests. Thank you, everyone, for listening and going on this Teal Swan epic journey with us. I also really want to say that I'm blown away by how many people wanted V-Week t-shirts and submitted their stories of how they listened to A Little Bit Culty.
Yeah.
We got stories from Baltimore, Toronto, Santa Barbara, South Africa, the UK, all around the world. And I wish I had t-shirts for everybody.
Does Teal Swan have a t-shirt? I want a Teal Swan t-shirt of her giving me that death stare. I would wear that thing to bed every night.
I feel like maybe we could add that to our merch once we finally get it up and running.
All right.
Coming soon. Thanks, bye. Everybody. You are awesome. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. Takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.